This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
I think about 10 to 15 minutes into the flight, there was a banging noise, and the GPS on the panel popped out, and the cowling was shaking, part of the windscreen cracked, and our power dropped to about 1,100.
Welcome to another edition of There I Was, a podcast where we put you in the cockpit with pilots in demanding situations, and we learn how they flew out of them. I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Today's guest is CFI Trevor Peterson. Trevor's a former Marine Corps tank commander who earned his private pilot certificate in 2018. After that, he banged through his ratings quickly, instrument, commercial, CFI, and today he's going to share a story with us flying in Southern California from John Wayne Airport to Camarillo as an instructor where the engine began running rough over some pretty crowded airspace. Trevor, thanks for joining us on the There I Was podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Trevor, your story is interesting because you're the CFI in the right seat of a 172. You've got about 1,200 or so hours total under your belt. A lot of that, though, is in 172-type airplanes and working through your ratings to go eventually to be a commercial pilot someday. But if you don't mind, share your story with us.
Yeah, sure. So, like you were saying, Richard, it was training flight with a student from John Wayne to Camarillo. We flew the route to Camarillo, fine, did a full stop taxi back at Camarillo, and then departed. I think about 10 to 15 minutes into the flight, there was a banging noise, and the GPS on the panel popped out, and the cowling was shaking, part of the windscreen cracked, and our power dropped. We were running about 2,400 RPMs. It was a new engine, only had about 30, 40 hours on it. So we're doing an engine break-in on it, but the power dropped to about 1,100. And when it did, I initially pulled the throttle back on it to try and ease the vibrations. And then once I did that, I tried to return it back in to try and reestablish some power. When I did that, it just started shaking worse. We only got about 200 more RPMs out of it, and that the RPM needle was kind of waving up and down.
So, Trevor, if I can interrupt you with a couple questions here. So share with us, if you will, your student. Like, where was he or she in their training? Were they a good student? Sure. You know, as an instructor, I have learned that it's the good students that you have to watch out for, because as an instructor, sometimes you get complacent, yeah. Right? You know, absolutely. if you're with a struggling student, you're kind of on your toes, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll find yourself getting complacent with good students. You have to be careful about that. But what was the background of your student at this time?
So Brian had just soloed, and we were getting into the cross-country phase of training. I think it was our first dual cross-country,
okay.
Actually. So, yeah, and Brian's a solid student, works really hard, but everything that we were doing was new to him. So I in that respect, I was kind of definitely on my toes, definitely involved in kind of every step of what we were doing.
So from an instructor standpoint, Trevor, this is a busy flight for you because you're teaching cross country with a good student, but he hasn't been cross country before, and you're doing it in some really busy airspace. So this is going to be a pretty demanding flight for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And the route that we take, we go through LA special flight rules. We're over LAX. And from a perspective of airspace, the position where we were in when we had started having issues is relatively light. It's kind of quietest, most easygoing portion of the flight. Flip side of that is we were in mountainous terrain. And that respect, it may be quiet airspace-wise, but as far as what's going on below us and attention to the kind of those details, you're on edge.
Yeah. So you'd come out of John Wayne, you'd navigated through that, you know, very busy airspace. And I think you said you were about over the Thousand Oaks area, somewhere in there when the engine began running rough.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay.
About what altitude were you?
We were at 3,500 and we were at that altitude kind of setting up to get ready to go through LA Special Flight Rules corridor going southeastbound.
So you had just taken off of Camarillo. You're headed towards John Wayne Airport and you know you're going to get ready for some really busy airspace.
Yeah.
So you're going through kind of the light. You're up about 3,500 feet or so, going through really the kind of the easier part from a navigation airspace standpoint. So you're kind of getting ready for that, only about the Thousand Oaks area or so, your engine starts running rough, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And what was the weather like? Was that a factor at all?
The weather wasn't a factor. The weather was good in Camarillo. En route was fine. But it's kind of funny this time of year, and in May, you get the marine layer right off the shore. So it was a concern, and it's almost to a point where I made a no-go decision on the flight. And it was kind of, we were back and forth on it, and then we did make the go decision. And then everything was really, really nice en route. It was working out fine.
Okay, weather really wasn't a factor for you. What time of year was this?
It was on May 31st.
Was it morning time?
It was actually the evening.
Okay.
So we departed about 5:30, 6 p.m. from John Wayne. So it was a late afternoon, early evening flight.
Okay, nice. So you were keeping your eye on your weather, but weather turns out good. So you climb up at 3,500. So at 3,500, that's rolling kind of hilly terrain. So you're kind of anywhere from maybe 500 to 1,500 AGL as you're going through this section?
I'd say closer to the 1,500, 2,000.
Okay.
Range, but really not very high at all.
Yeah. Okay. And so pick it up from there, please. The engine starts running rough. And you said the first thing you thought, and really heavy vibration, and it's a new engine, which is kind of, we'll talk about that, this infant mortality, as it's called for engines.
Yeah.
But you pull it to idle.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really help, right?
It eased the intensity, the vibration. And it lessened it to an extent. It was still vibrating more than it should be, right?
Yeah.
And at that point, I put the power back in to kind of see if maybe we had eased some complication or whatever was wrong with it. And it started to, you know, just go back to the way it was running.
Yeah.
And I think at that point, we noticed that the oil pressure had just dropped on it.
Mm.
So
who was flying when the engine began running rough?
Fairly certain Brian was. And then really the second that it popped and it started shaking, I took controls. And, you know, typically you have positive exchange of controls and all that. I think in that moment, it was just Brian knew that it was on me and I was taking over entirely at that point.
Yeah. Talk to us about that from the CFI perspective. So, you know, it's going to be a busy flight. You're getting ready to go in some busy airspace. You're cruising along. He's flying. You're obviously doing a lot monitoring. The engine starts running rough. Is this a part of your pre-brief with students? Do you tell them, okay, in case of an emergency, you know, I'll take the airplane or you keep flying it until I take it? Or how do you brief that?
Yeah, that's pretty much a day one lesson. You teach students the safety briefing, the pre-takeoff briefing, all that. And it's reviewed, you know, over and over again. As far as training is concerned, I'm always, as the CFI, I'm always PIC, and I'm always going to take over in the event of an actual emergency. And you, like I said, you teach these good habits of positive exchange of controls and all that. And in that instant, when it did happen, it was just immediately assumed. There was no discussion.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that I was taking over at that point.
I think that's an important aspect of when you're flying with somebody. And this is especially when you're doing like an endorsement or a biannual flight review or something,
mm-hmm.
where you make it clear. And I'll usually tell them, hey, you're always flying the airplane until I take it. Mm-hmm. So in case of an emergency, you're still flying the airplane until I take it. But when I do take it, I want to see your hands off the controls and, you know, very positive transfer there.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that happened largely due to the fact that you had discussed it earlier and said, hey, in event of emergency, I'm taking the airplane. He knew that was going to be the case. And he also probably saw and felt you just take control of the situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so then from that point, you pulled the power back. It helped a little, but you tried to push it forward to get more thrust. And that just made the situation worse. The oil pressure's dropping. Mm-hmm. Pick it up from there.
Yeah. So at that point, I put the power back in, just again, went back to running as poorly as it was prior to. And it was kind of at that point, I knew I was in an emergency situation. And my initial thought was we were going to try and divert somewhere and try to get Brian to be as helpful as he could. And I asked him to kind of find Van Nuys on a map. And he was just kind of unsure of exactly what I was asking. So I kind of knew it was on me to figure out what was going to happen. And I started looking for Van Nuys as a potential diversion airport, and just quickly knew that it was unrealistic. And we were going to land within a 2 mile radius of where we were at that time. Mm.
Were you on flight following at this point?
Yes. Yeah. We were with SoCal okay. Approach, and, part of knowing I was diverting, knowing that we were having an issue, I remember the moment of panic, and I put out a Mayday call, and that's really all I said was Mayday twice, and SoCal came back over, and they said, aircraft transmitting Mayday call, you know, what's your call sign, what's going on? And that was kind of the height of the panic state, and I keyed out, said 99 uniform engine out, and then I also remember explicitly the moment after I said that, it was just complete calm and it was just executing. I knew what we were doing and I knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. And so what did you do from there? You said you thought this thing was going down within 2 miles. Then you were still running, it sounds like, but your oil pressure had dropped. So, you know, when that oil pressure goes to zero, it's going to seize, right? So,
yeah.
And it sounds like you knew that was coming.
Yeah.
You make your Mayday call. Then what? What'd you do from there? Are you establishing best glide? Were you looking around for it just doesn't look like you'd find a lot of places to put it down there in terms of fields or open places.
Yeah. So best glide was the first thing I set up. I did pretty much full trim down deflection, which kind of sets you up pretty well in the 172. And then I was looking at places to land. And in that area, there was a golf course below us that was just really windy. There were a lot of trees, and I kind of considered that. There was a lake that was really, really pretty small, and then there was the 101 was kind of the three options that I was weighing. And traffic was surprisingly really light that evening, and I've kind of gathered that was the best option to give us a chance for survival, and considered that while we may put people on the ground at risk, it was light enough that I felt I had a good opportunity for, you know, the best possible outcome, risking minimal people on the ground and kind of keeping us alive in the situation.
Yeah. So once again, just a crowded place. So there wasn't any really good options. So you're trying to balance all the factors of not making your emergency somebody else's crisis. And I really believe strongly in that point. And also finding a place where you can put the aircraft down where, you know, you guys inside the aircraft will be okay. So all of that stuff is very quickly going through your mind. And because of the light traffic on the 101, you decide, hey, this is probably the best option. Different day, different traffic, maybe a completely different option, right? But yeah. Given what you saw, that was your best option, which turned out to be a very good choice. But I'm getting ahead of you here, but you mentioned you said trim down. So talk to me about establishing the best glide in the 172. It sounds like you have a technique for that.
Oh, nose up trim. You rotate the
full
wheel,
nose up trim.
Wheel down. Yeah, okay. So nose up trim, right?
Okay. So you basically, if you have an engine out scenario in a 172, you go full nose up trim and that'll get you pretty close to best glide?
It usually puts you close. Sometimes it puts you a little bit slower. It just depends on the aircraft itself.
Yeah.
So I don't remember if it was full down, but it is pretty much rotating the wheel all the way down gives you 60-65. And if you're slow, you just rotate nose down a little bit more.
Okay. So when you decide on the 101, how high were you and how far away was it at that point?
I'd say we were about maybe 2,900 to 3,000 when we made that decision.
So you're, yeah, AGL-wise, you're...
2,000 AGL at best, I'd say.
And so was it a factor of making sure you could glide to get there, or you had plenty of glide range to get there? It was more setting yourself up in the optimum position on the freeway.
Pretty much. We were right on top of the point that we touched down at, and talking about weighing options. I remember there were, I want to say, three sections of the 101 that I was looking at. And the one that I picked, for whatever reason, just stood out to me. And I looked at the going northbound, and for whatever reason, southbound just seemed like the best option. Looking back on it, that was probably the least calculated thing that I thought about. I just looked down and I saw a portion that I liked for whatever reason. And we had plenty of glide distance, so we really flew almost a standard traffic pattern down to the point that I selected.
And did you land with the southbound traffic or against it? How'd you handle that?
Yeah, with it. Okay. And that was something that was going through my mind immediately as soon as we were going down. I knew if I selected the 101, I would go with traffic. It was just a matter of what segment and whether I wanted to go northbound or southbound.
So the good news is you selected somewhere to land right underneath you so you could set yourself up for a pattern that felt really familiar to you in terms of your altitude and your speeds. Mm-hmm. And the thing that can be tricky about a highway, though, is power lines coming across it. You know, maybe not so much a factor on a freeway, but bridges, road signs, light poles, right? You're probably just scanning like crazy for all those kind of obstacles.
Absolutely. The two big considerations in the section that we took were, we were between two overpasses, and there was multiple overpasses underneath us in the segments that I was kind of evaluating. And I believe power lines were kind of running parallel to the freeway in the segment that we selected, and not too many road signs. But I do remember when we crossed, because I picked a segment between two overpasses. Every segment that I was looking at was between overpasses. Mm-hmm. And when we crossed the first overpass, starting the segment I was in, I think we were probably 200-300 AGL. And at that point, I pulled the mixture and the prop stopped windmilling at that point and went full flap deflection. I actually put it in a forward slip for a moment too. And we just kind of dropped down as fast as we could into that segment I'd selected.
Yeah, because you're trying to get it in between these two overpasses, right? So it's no longer about stretching a glide with best glide speed. It's about you found the place to land. It's about the optimum position and speed for the landing.
Yeah, exactly. And making sure that we touched down before reaching the second overpass.
Were there any cars? Did you have to worry about like trying to fit in between cars, or tell us about the traffic and if there was any or how they reacted?
It was fairly light. I remember there were about, I want to say, four cars in vicinity of kind of the area where we were shooting to touch down. And what I tried to do once I got low enough and I knew I could put it down relatively quickly was level out for just a moment to try and give drivers on the road some situational awareness that we were, you know, in the area, and just kind of floated it for a moment. You know, I can't remember how I timed it, but after we floated for a moment, just pushed it down and got it on the ground. Again, just trying to get it down as fast as possible.
And so tell us what it's like landing on a freeway. I mean, how'd the landing itself go?
You know, it was pretty smooth, actually. I do remember the nose wheel touching down pretty abruptly, so not the ideal soft field landing, but it was smooth. And rolling out, I don't know if in the moment, but I remember telling Brian either then or afterwards that I've played through this scenario in my head probably a million times, right? And you're rolling down the freeway thinking of all those times that you've thought about making emergency landings. But I remember the most surprising thing, and when I look at the or go on like news outlets and stuff, everybody says, you know, cars are still zipping by you. We kept having cars pass by us on the left, and that was just the most amazing thing to me was people did not care at all. The plane that just landed in front of them, they were just trying to keep going down the 101.
get on about their day. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
So tell us about that. When you landed, you're rolling out. Did you like move over to the right side? Did you pull it off the freeway? How much work did you put into trying to keep it off the road so that, you know, traffic could resume?
I was trying to push it to the right as best as possible, you know, while being kind of cautious. At that point, I didn't want to clip the wing on something and then have a spiral or whatever. So I got it to the right as best I could. And kind of another kind of funny point about that is when, you know, my boss, the owner, came, he's like, "You didn't put a scratch on the plane, even though the tires aren't bald." And really that attributed to, I just kept the plane rolling. I didn't want to slam on the brakes or stop too abruptly in case someone was behind us or whatever. I didn't know what was going on, but we rolled maybe for a good half mile, a mile down the road. And when we finally did stop, we just sat there for a moment, and then CHP pulled up behind us. And at that moment we jumped out, and we had rolled right up to what's called the Ray's Adobe exit. And, you know, once CHP showed up, there was kind of a moment of what now? But then we just pulled the tow bar out and started towing it up the Ray's Adobe off ramp. And it was funny. CHP was helping us, and we heard, you know, the fire department coming, and CHP says, "Great, here comes the heroes." And these fire trucks come down the Ray's Adobe exit, and the CHP is all pissed off because now they're blocking the way that we're trying to get the plane up. But, you know, CHP and the LA County Fire helped us, and we just pushed the plane up the off ramp.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52.
Okay, so you push it up the off ramp. Sounds like almost within minutes of you rolling out. So now the freeway is pretty much unblocked, mm-hmm. and you've got it over there. So here you are. You just survived, you know, an engine failure.
Yeah.
Survived landing on the 101, and you push it off, and you're talking to the police and the fire. And now what? What'd you do from there?
The first thing I did was I called my boss. And he pretty much said he's on his way. I think the next call I got was from the NTSB and the FAA. So we were just kind of, I guess, isolated and on this side street at that point. And we were just surrounded by people. And I was just kind of standing in the middle, taking call after call from, like I said, FAA, NTSB, calling me multiple times. But yeah, from the point of touchdown on, I didn't know what to do. I didn't. It was all new to me.
There's not a manual for that. It's no. You can look in the POH, but it's nowhere in there.
Yeah, freeway landing operations.
Yeah. So if we can, let's back up a little bit, Trevor, and talk about. So first of all, just congratulations on handling that situation and all the things that were going through your mind in relatively short order. And the decision you made was obviously the right one for that time of day and that circumstance in the 101. What was your student doing at the time? So you take control of the airplane, you're trying to think through your options. What was your student doing at the time?
He was doing the best he could to help out. He was trying to spot points on the ground. He was making recommendations. He was doing everything he could to try and be helpful. And for the most part, I was on my own, and I was working through things to the best of my ability. Mm-hmm. And he was, like I said, trying his best to help out. He kind of panicked a little bit before we touched down, but really, to be honest, I was kind of shut off.
Yeah,
I was.
You were focused.
Yeah. Aviate, navigate, communicate. Yeah. I was just aviating at that point.
Yeah, which isn't a bad thing. You've got all the help you need. You know where you're going to put it down. There's no other distraction you need. You're focused, right? So that in my mind, that's not a bad thing. Yeah. You know, it's when you have that help in the cockpit, I think it's helpful to remember help is determined by the receiver, right? And in this case, you're the receiver. And, you know, there have been some cases where people were trying to help and it ended up being a distraction to the pilot. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes the best case is for them to sit there, maybe anticipate, think through in their own mind, but be ready to respond to your inputs or things they see going awry. But there's a lot to be said about, you know, stay out of the way. So,
yeah.
Sounds like he was reading that situation pretty well.
He was, like I said, he was doing everything he could do to help out. But really, I knew exactly what I was doing after the first 20 seconds of something going wrong. And anything he really said was, I heard him, but
yeah.
the point at which I was making considerations to change anything I was doing had passed. And it was just about executing my plan.
Yeah. So I want to go back a little bit and talk about, you had mentioned when it first happened, when the engine first started running rough, there was a little bit of panic in you. And that to me is intriguing because, I mean, you're a tank commander.
Yeah.
You know, you're very well qualified in stressful conditions, handling machinery. And yet, despite that, despite all your training as a CFI and all the training you'd given to students about engine failure and all that, when it actually happened to you, there was a couple seconds there of, you know, kind of, oh my gosh, panic, as you described it. And then you kind of take a deep breath, you let your training, you sort of take control of the situation mentally. Talk to us about that reaction and then, you know, how you handled it.
Yeah, so I guess it's kind of funny, you know, Marine Corps, everything that we do is training for war, right? And I remember, you know, when I was a second first lieutenant and we were doing these training exercises, you know, every time you go out, it's always kind of the prevalent thought, you know, I'm never going to use this. This is the stuff we're doing is excessive. And then you meet guys with experience who are telling you to take it seriously. So you try your best to, you know, put yourself in the situation, put yourself in the mindset, but it's always kind of in the back of your mind. Like, is this really going to happen? And I think that's kind of the same when you're training with students, when you're doing emergency procedures, you know, it's in the back of the student's mind. Why are we doing this? And until you're in the situation, it's kind of something that this will never happen to me. And in that moment, it was kind of like in that panic moment, it's like this questioning, is this really happening? I can't believe this is happening. Mm-hmm. And you're going through that. And once you just accept the situation, then it's just about training. It's about executing what you've done over and over again, always with that kind of seed of doubt that it'll ever will happen, that you've executed it so many times.
You know what? That I love the phrase that you just used, accept the situation. Mm-hmm. So it seems like from your experience, there's a couple seconds in there where you're just accepting, okay, yes, my engine did fail. This is the situation. And that's why I think in my Air Force training and other training that I've had in general aviation, we factor in a startle period for just exactly what you're talking about. It seems like no matter how well trained and prepared you are, when it actually happens to you, you're going to go through this couple seconds where you're like, what is going on? Is this really happening?
Yeah.
Okay. A couple seconds before you accept the situation and then, you know, let your training kick in.
Yeah, exactly. And I was reading through emergency procedures. One of the things that said in there was what can kill people sometimes is that they don't accept the reality of the situation and they try and do things outside the limitations of what can happen given the circumstances. So to your point, training people to go through that startle period and accept whatever situation they're in is extremely important.
Yeah. And I think accepting the options that are available to you, not the options that you want, the options that are available to you, right? And I think that's where people get in trouble is when they, for example, we've seen this in general aviation, when they're lost their engine or something and they're establishing a glide. And what they really want to do is make it to the airport or make it to this open field. And they don't accept the reality that you don't have the airspeed or the glide ratio to do that. That's not a realistic option. So peel back into the circle of realistic options, not the circle of desired options, right?
Right, yeah.
And it sounds like that's kind of what you were going through is you didn't want to land on the 101.
Yeah.
But it was really the only good option of the options you had available to you.
Right, yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about landing on highways and techniques there. I was up in Alaska doing some bush flying and we were in a Pacer In Alaska, it's legal to land on the highways, and I wanted to land on the highway for the experience of doing it. And the instructor I was flying with said, okay, you know, great. Here's some techniques and things to think about when you're landing on a highway. And one of the things that he mentioned to me that I've never forgotten in case the situation ever presented itself to me was he said, if you're landing behind someone, 100% of the time, they will hit their brakes in a car. So you must allow for that and establish enough spacing to where it's not going to be a factor to you if they slam on the brakes, because that's going to happen. And I've never forgotten that. So I wondered, it sounded like that wasn't a factor for you had plenty of forward space. You weren't too worried about that.
Yeah, no, there was nobody in front of us, and we had plenty of time to roll down the freeway. And just to be perfectly honest, I mean, I have limited freeway landing experience, but that wasn't on my mind at the time. But luckily we didn't have to deal with that situation.
And then I also want to talk about infant mortality in engines, what Mike Bush calls infant mortality. And that is that actually, statistically, newer engines are riskier, you know, from that standpoint, than older engines that have been flying a while because of this concept of infant mortality. It's just, you know, statistically. Now, fortunately, engine outs and engine failures are rare in general aviation. But in your case, you know, you happen to be one of the ones that got hit by this rarity. Did they ever figure out what was wrong when you were in the first 20 hours or so? So you're breaking the engine in. Did they ever figure out what the problem was?
Yeah, they did. I think the investigation's all wrapped up, so I don't think it's an issue to talk about it. But on the 172, there was an old internal oil filter, and they started making adapters to make an external oil filter. So when the engine for that aircraft was overhauled, the shop asked if they wanted to put the external oil filter adapter on, which we opted for. And when we finally took it apart, the adapter hadn't been torqued down enough. And you could see that the seal started getting pressure from it being too loose and the pressure building up behind it. And it eventually just blew through that seal. The torquing on the external adapter loosened up enough that pressure built on the seal and it failed.
And that's kind of a very typical reason why younger engines fail, you know, more than older engines, because it's like what Mike Bush calls major surgery.
Yeah,
you know, when you go in and overhaul an engine and do these things, and there's just a lot of room for human error.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why that is an issue, and why you have to be so careful, you know, with new engines coming out to make sure you break them in properly and, you know, all the appropriate procedures there. So kind of interesting that happened to you.
Yeah.
And the final thing I want to talk to you about, Trevor, is we talked a little bit about it, but that is, as a CFI, having an emergency when you have a student on board, the student's flying, but you as the CFI are always in control of the airplane. And I try to make that point early on when I'm flying with students in that, especially if they're younger students and they're new, maybe they haven't soloed, and you explain to them, okay, in the event of emergency, I will take control of the aircraft immediately, you know, show me your hands. And so forth. As they get more developed in their experience and they've soloed, I'll typically transition and say, okay, in the event of emergency, keep flying the airplane until I take it. And then we'll have a positive change of control. And then the final situation I usually brief them on is, you know, as they're coming in, this is especially when you're doing like tailwheel endorsements and that kind of thing, is that, hey, you may feel me nudging the controls. This is especially in tailwheels for sure. You may feel me on the rudder a little bit. I may nudge your stick here and there, but I'm not flying the airplane unless I tell you I have the airplane. So I think that transfer of positive aircraft control is very important, and how you do it and when you do it changes depending on the student, where they are in their training, and depending on the situation. And in this case, it sounds to me like you guys had relied on briefings that you'd given him previously, that he knew if something happens to this airplane, I'm taking control, and you took control of it in such a way that there was no doubt in his mind you were flying the airplane.
Yeah, absolutely. There was no question. Like I said earlier, it's something we brief from the get-go, and given the situation, I'm pretty sure he didn't want to fly at that point.
Right, yeah,
But he knew. He knew that I was taking over. He knew what he needed to do, and it was just about execution.
Yeah. And it sounds like, obviously, it went really well. So congratulations to you on handling what could have been a pretty demanding, well, was a demanding situation, but congratulations on a safe outcome for you, your student, the airplane, people on the ground. Nice job, Trevor.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, Trevor, is there anything that we haven't talked about? Any points you wanted to stress?
I think one other big point that when I was talking to the FAA investigator, they were all glad with the outcome. And one thing the investigator said, he's like, I'm not really a big fan of freeway landings, but you did the best you could with the circumstance you were in. And one thing that kind of stood out to me that was going through my mind that I picked up in the military was that a 70% solution executed violently now is better than 100% solution after it's too late. And that's just kind of something that I've always thought about when I kind of rehashed the event, was that I just picked a solution to the problem and went with it 100%, as opposed to, and again, what we were talking about earlier is accepting the situation. You accept the situation and you just act on it. You don't wait to come up with a better answer once it's too late.
Boy, that's a great point, Trevor. I'm glad you brought that up. And that is, don't spend too much mental energy on the perfect solution. Mm-hmm. Find one that's going to work and then focus like you did. I mean, it sounds like you were really focused on execution. And that's what you did so well. And so you look back and, think, oh, well, could you have done this? Could you have done that? Well, maybe. But
yeah,
I did do this and it worked out well. So that's a great point.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your story with us, Trevor.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, nice job, Trevor Peterson. There's some great lessons learned that came out of that, especially for CFIs and how you handle aircraft control, how you brief your students on an emergency, and then what they can do in the student role to help you, importantly, not distract you. And I thought the panic discussion was interesting coming from his background, and yet he still went through a couple seconds of panic and startle factor until, in his words, accept the reality of the situation. And that's what he did so well. So we're glad for that outcome. And Trevor, thank you so much for sharing your story alongside our producer, David O'Leary. I'm your host, Richard McSpadden. Fly safe.
There I Was is produced by the AOPA Air Safety Institute. If you'd like to hear other episodes, submit comments, or submit your own story to potentially be featured on the show, please visit airsafetyinstitute.org/thereiwas. Thanks for listening.